Call the Special Committee on Natural Gas Development to order. We have Senator Dyson, Senator Stedman, Senator Wilkins, myself, Senator Segan, Senator Wagner, Senator Ben Stevens, Senator Bundy, Senator Hoffman, Senator Elton. Also with us, we have Senator Gary Stevens, Senator Charlie Huggins, Representative John Coghill, Senator Ellis, Senator French. Other members? With that, Representative Samuels. Anyone else? Don't see anyone else at the moment. We'll try to recognize as they come in. First topic of our agenda today, we have visitors from BP. And, oh, Senator Green is with us. And I, as chairman, am going to turn the gavel over to the chairman of the Resources Committee, Senator Wagner, to conduct this part of the meeting. Senator Wagner.
Thank you. Mr. Malone, just to set some parameters on this, first, I've talked to Representative Samuels and Representative Ramirez, the co-chairs of the House Resource Committee, and we're talking about having a joint committee meeting in Anchorage next Thursday or Friday to go into this in greater detail. I know your time is limited, and therefore, it's what I'd like to do today is receive the presentation from you and Mr. Marshall and whoever else you have, give you more time to put together a more complete presentation. Give us some time to absorb what you say today and maybe have some questions that are pertinent to your problems in North Slope by that time. So I'll turn the meeting over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and my thanks for this opportunity to come down today and share with you.
Please introduce each one of your staff for the record, if you would, and then won't have to stop for introductions.
My name is Bob Malone. I'm chairman and president of BP America.
Steve Marshall, president, BP Exploration Alaska.
Bill Hedges, manager of corrosion strategy and planning.
Thanks.
Thank you. If I could, I'd like to begin by expressing our deep regrets that we found it necessary to take this drastic measure of the orderly shutdown of the Prudhoe Bay field. On behalf of the BP group, I want to apologize to the great state of Alaska and, in fact, to our nation for this act, the actions that we have to take today. I can assure you that BP will put all the necessary human and financial resources behind a program to bring our production back up as safely and as quickly as we possibly can. We'll be working with the federal and state regulators over the next days, hours, days, and weeks to develop a program for that orderly shutdown of the Prudhoe Bay field. But we're also going to be running a parallel study, work that will run parallel to that effort to see if there are opportunities to safely maintain some level of production. And what I mean by that is there may be opportunities that, working with the state and federal agencies, there may be certain lines that we can keep in operation, and if so, and if we're convinced, all of us, that we can do this safely and the integrity be maintained, we would do this. We've now also announced today, we've taken the decision that we are going to replace all of the main transit lines in Prudhoe Bay with new lines. Now, this will be part of a work plan that'll be incorporated into that first phase program and the second phase program, but we will replace all those transit lines on the North Slope. Our work plan, and I'd like to just touch on the top four priorities that we have. These are our four priorities. First is to assure the safety and integrity of our operating infrastructure. Secondly, to minimize any impact on the environment. Third is to continue the cooperative working relationship with the relevant state and federal agencies. And fourthly, to restore production as soon as it is safe, and I'll emphasize safe, to accomplish that task. So we will do that as soon as possible. Those are our four priorities. Again, my purpose for being here today is to emphasize to you our regrets and apologies. Secondly, that we have a work plan in place. From our initial announcement, we do have that parallel track to look at, is it feasible to maintain some of the production? And it's too early to tell at this point in time, but we will be running that track. I'll now ask maybe if sorry, Chairman, for Steve Marshall to bring you to what led to this decision and where we are today.
I'd like to recognize Senator Davis that's joined us. And go ahead, Steve.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Bob. If I could also offer my apologies and regret. I wish we're here not to discuss it, but to discuss other matters, and that we're going to leave no stone unturned in our efforts to get production safely back on stream. What we had been doing over the last few weeks and months is to conduct operations in accordance with the Department of Transportation Compliance Action Order, which requires us to clean, scrape, and smart pig all of the transit lines at Prudhoe Bay. And through smart pigging, the information from that would give us definitive information on the condition and location of any defects in those lines, such that we could take the appropriate action to repair and or make replacement. We had completed one of those transit lines through pigging, Lisbon, and had confirmed that that line was in very good shape, and that line was put back into service. That line remains in service and will remain in service throughout this at about 17,000 barrels per day. The second of those lines, from Flow Station 2 in the east side of Prudhoe Bay to Flow Station 1, is a 30-inch line that had been cleaned, scraped, and smart pigged. And then on late last week, on Friday, we received the preliminary information back on that smart pigging. That information suggested that we had 16 anomalies, 16 defects, which indicated wall thickness loss in excess of 70%. What the smart pigging does then, it leads you to those 16 locations to go back and use ultrasonic testing to further verify and accurately pinpoint where exactly those defects are and corroborate the smart pigging information. We started that activity over the weekend, and at about early Sunday morning yesterday, about 5:30, 6 o'clock, in removing the insulation at one of those locations, we identified some oil-stained insulation. No leak, but some oil-stained insulation. At that point in time, we decided to shut down Flow Station 2, about 33,000 barrels per day, and proceed with the investigation of the remaining anomalies and defects. In doing so, we noticed one location, a spill, a small leak, which resulted in about 4 to 5 barrels of crude oil leaking onto the Tundra. That was contained, and the cleanup has started. We've recovered about half of that oil so far, as of 8 o'clock this morning, and we'll continue to do so. That was leaking at about 6 gallons per minute. That is slowing down. We've isolated the line, we've put a vacuum on it, and that rate of leakage is slowing down, and we're evacuating that oil in a good manner, so there will be no further spillage. But it indicates that that leak had been occurring for about 15 minutes, sometime after Flow Station 2 was shut down. So these results were unexpected. The testing we'd done prior to the smart pigging did not indicate this level of damage. So yesterday we took the decision to say that given that this was appeared to be a different corrosion mechanism to that which we'd seen on the GC2 line spill in March, we said we need to take a systematic approach to shutting down the rest of the field so we can corroborate or further understand the condition of the remaining lines before we put them back into service. So we consider that to be a prudent, very significant action we are taking. But we consider it a very prudent action, and one which we're proceeding with all diligence, but also caution to ensure that safety and care for the environment remains the number one priority. Thank you.
I want to limit the questions as much as possible. These gentlemen have about 30 minutes to make their presentation, then they got to go to the House. So let's be very brief with questions. Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You'd mentioned two possible different kinds of corrosion, and of course the thing that probably comes to many people's minds, certainly mine, that if there's this corrosion problem in these feeder lines, how does that impact the main taps line? Is the crude composition the same, or are there other corrosion techniques used on taps that weren't used on the feeder lines?
Senator Bundy, in discussions with Alyeska, and from history of my days at Alyeska Pipeline, Alyeska uses a mechanism to dewax and clean the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. They use corrosion inhibitors, and then they also run smart pigs through the line as a matter of course. And to my knowledge, and in recent conversations, this problem does not exist on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
And if just follow up, then it's probably safe to assume that the TAPS kind of activity will probably be extended to feeder lines then in the future.
Just a comment, I think, for all of us, and I'd like to ask Bill to comment, but just we believe, as we did with our regulators, that we had a satisfactory program of corrosion control on those infield lines. We now know it was not adequate, or we wouldn't have had the leak and the corrosion. So we will be modifying our program, moving it to all the recent technology and science that we can find in order to enhance that program to assure that this doesn't happen again.
I'd like to recognize Representative Crawford has joined us. Senator Dyson.
Thank you. Steve, the anomalies you've found, are there more of them on one side of the lease than the other, one side of the field?
Senator Dyson, the section of line we're looking at right now is from flow station 2 to flow station 1. It's the section of transit lines that's to the furthest to the east.
Yeah.
The GC2 line that failed is the line, the 34-inch line, that's furthest to the west. What we do know about this line is that the velocity of oil through the line is perhaps the lowest of any in the field. It's about half a foot per second. And that compares to some of the higher flow rates, say the GC1 section of line, which runs at 2 feet per second. And again, it's very early days, but we think that that has some bearing on the ability of the fluids to keep the water from dropping out and forming and staying in the line, and perhaps may have some attribution to the corrosion mechanism. But it's very early days. I hesitate to kind of say too much about that, but we've only looked at this section of line with the Smart Pig and the Lisbon line. The Lisbon line did not show any significant damage. It was in very good condition. It's a somewhat newer line. It was installed in the mid-80s, and this is the first of the 1977 vintage transit lines that we've actually managed to smart pig.
So what I was doing was giving you an opportunity to say your parent firm's lines were in better shape than some of the others, but you're not doing any blame shifting, and I appreciate that. And maybe when Bill's up, you can comment on whether or not there's any possibility that new metallurgy and coatings are available now might give a better corrosion resistance environment. And I assume from what you've said also that none of the problems you're seeing are corrosion, not erosion.
Yes, Senator, that's absolutely right. The problems are clearly corrosion. And one good thing that we do know is the corrosion is very much limited to the very bottom of the pipeline in the 6 o'clock position. So we know exactly where to look circumferentially. The problem is we don't know exactly where to look along the length. The tricky thing about this corrosion is that it's in the form of discrete pits. It's not an interlinked network of damage, as, for example, was found in the late 80s and early 90s due to carbon dioxide corrosion. That attacked a broad surface area, which was much easier to find. As Steve said, it's a little bit early to speculate, but from what we've seen, the pits do look like they're formed from microbiological activity, bacteria. So the answer to your question is yes, it's corrosion, definitely not erosion. The velocities in this line are so low that erosion really couldn't be a problem. Probably the best mechanism we have to control the corrosion is to keep the lines clean, one, and remove the solids that the bacteria hide underneath, and then two, treat them with the chemicals that we're already using, but because the solids won't be there to protect them, they'll attack the bacteria and kill them. So yes, it's corrosion, and I think conventional control methods will do a good job.
And not better coatings or metallurgy, probably?
In this particular case, no. Coatings would be an option. A different choice of metallurgy. With, for example, stainless steels, it's the jury is still out on whether stainless steels actually do offer better resistance to bacteria or not. And often you trade one set of problems for another set of problems. I think Prudhoe Bay has demonstrated that we can use carbon steel systems very well. They've already significantly exceeded original design life. We have every intent of making them last a lot longer. We have a mechanism here that we weren't expecting in these particular lines.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Okay, continue. Is that the basis of your presentation pretty well?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chairman.
Well, contrary to what I said, I guess we take a few more questions. We got about another 10 minutes for your time. Senator Elton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for taking time out of what I can only imagine has to be one of the most hectic days of your lives to give us this briefing. And I don't expect an answer to this question, but perhaps you can pass it along to the people who are dealing with the other issue that we're confronted with in this special session. That's a change in the oil and gas tax regime, and so I would be interested if your company could get back in touch with members of the committee to try, not you, you have other things that you're doing, but somebody from the company to try and give some kind of an idea to the committee what the task in front of you involves. I mean, charge off to capital expense, what you charge off to operating expenses, so that it can help us deal with some of the issues on the other side. And then just a quick question that maybe you can discuss. You mentioned that you're talking now about replacing all the transit lines in the Prudhoe Bay unit. Can you give us some kind of an idea of how much steel that means and the availability of steel and pipe to accomplish what you're talking about?
Yes, Senator Elton. I'll try and give you an estimate of what that involves. The line sizes vary from 30-inch to 34-inch, depending on which section of the field it is. The Lisbon line is also 24-inch, but that we're not planning replacing it, at least at this time. What we will probably do is not replace like for like. We will take the opportunity to install smaller lines, which are better suited to the volumes of production that we're experiencing today. For example, GC2 used to produce 330,000 barrels a day at startup. That's why it required a 34-inch line. The replacement line we've already ordered for that is 18-inch. We think that's better suited. It will promote higher velocities, will mitigate considerably some of the risks of settling that appear to have occurred in at least one or two of these lines. So we'll be looking at a combination of 18, possibly 24-inch, maybe even 12-inch lines to replace them. We have put out requests worldwide, not only in the state, to find out what level of 12-inch, 18-inch, 24-inch steel is available, and to look in existing inventories to see if we can actually get up somebody else's order, get to the top of the scale to get that steel up here as quickly as possible. What I can't give you today is a precise and accurate plan of what that looks like. It's going to take us some time to do the proper in-depth engineering on that. But as soon as we do, we'll be happy to come back and share that with you. And in response to your first question, I'd be happy, as we get a better sense of what commitments we're taking. I think we take we follow the good accounting practice in terms of what becomes capitalized, what is charged to expense in terms of ongoing surveillance, cleanup, and capital modifications or repairs. So, again, we'd be happy to come back and give you a better view of that at the appropriate time.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? If not, we have John Norman with us from the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. John, do you have any comments? John, are you on the line?
I am on the line.
Okay. Do you have any comments?
No, unless there are questions. I think everything has been pretty thoroughly covered. We have been receiving very good briefings from the operator, BP. The events of yesterday were immediately reported around noon, and then we've been receiving constant stream of briefings. We have AOGCC inspectors on the North Slope, and so I would be happy to respond to any questions, but I don't want to take your time right now because the information is still coming in on these events.
Yeah, did you hear my earlier comments about the possibility of a joint resources meeting in Anchorage next Thursday or Friday?
No, I'm sorry I didn't. We were just coming out of the BP noon briefing and I missed that.
Okay, well, we haven't scheduled it yet, but we're talking about those dates if there can be more information, more detailed presentations at that time.
Well, we'll make sure we're available at whatever time you schedule it. We'll have either myself or one of the commissioners there.
Thanks, John. Senator Bundy?
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chairman. John, did I understand that you're getting the information you need and on a timely basis?
Yes. Yes, we are. We're getting it, and in addition, we have access to all of the personnel, and there will be daily briefings for the duration until we can begin to see a trend line here as to how soon that they will be able to ramp up and begin production again.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman,
Senator Bundy,
it might be interesting if we could be in the loop of that communication, get a synopsis of the briefings at least.
We'll request that, get it distributed. Anything else, gentlemen? Senator Seekins, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We just a couple of questions. I'm not a petroleum engineer. When you clean and scrape the bigger pipes, what kind of solids do you generally generate? How do you handle those? What kind of downstream threat does that have? Even in, are you able to get those out of the line adequately to be able not to end up with some of those in the main pipe?
Senator. You can get a variety of things out of pipes, which is, always astounds me. The things that we see, particularly on the North Slope, are on the west side of the field, which is where we first had the leak. We get a lot of sand out. Clearly, if you've had corrosion in the line, you can get corrosion products out of the line. And you always get oily hydrocarbon residues out of the line as well, solid particles of wax and asphaltenes. On the east side, in addition to all of those things, we've also been seeing mineral scale, calcium carbonate, much as would build up in a domestic boiler system. That's because of the nature of the water that comes out of the ground. In all honesty, I don't personally perceive the solids pose a direct threat in themselves. never good to have them in there. The threat that they pose is that they allow bacteria to harbour underneath them. The solids themselves are non-corrosive, but the bacteria can hide underneath those solids, and the chemicals that we deploy to kill the bacteria don't penetrate the solids and get to them. So solids per se are not a problem, although we don't like them in our lines because they hide and shield bacteria. If you go at high velocity, solids can be a problem because you can move into an erosion regime where the solids will be moving so fast they'll physically abrade metal off the surface of the pipe. That isn't an issue for our pipelines or the Trans-Alaska pipeline. The biggest problem for Alyeska with solids is they have very good systems of filtering the solids out before they get into their systems. The problem we would give them if we dumped all of these solids on them in one go, it would plug up their filtration systems and give them operational difficulties. They will have a certain amount of solids continuously entering their line. Our specification to Alyeska is 0.35% of base sediment and water. So if you multiply the total volume going down Trans-Alaska by 0.35%, that's the, on average, the volume of sediment, maximum sediment we can give them. But they deal with that very comfortably by continuously pigging it out of their lines.
If I could just add a comment there, Senator. Our reliance, historical reliance, on ultrasonic testing was clearly inadequate. Once we have cleaned these lines, or whether we've installed new lines, it is our absolute intention that we're going to rely on maintenance pigging on a regular basis such that these problems do not crop up in the future.
Anticipated my next question is what, if you're not doing that now, the ultrasonic testing is what you've been relying on in the past. And my next question was, what are you looking for doing as
we move forward? Senator, it will be a combination of techniques, and we'll be using the best techniques we can find anywhere in the world, whether that's new technologies, a combination of technologies, but it certainly will include regular maintenance pigging and smart pigging, which will then lead you to points of concern which you can go to specifically and do ultrasonic testing to confirm, corroborate, or otherwise. That the problem with ultrasonic testing alone is that you can't test every inch of the line every day. And I think that has been the Achilles heel of our program.
Sure. And if I could, one more. The question then, somebody owes donuts. The question then is as you've identified these anomalies, I realize that you're saying your intent over time here is to replace all of the main transit lines on the North Slope. But are you planning on doing, what kind of a time frame are you planning on doing that over? Are you planning on addressing these areas of anomaly now? How would you address that? Replace sections of that pipe or sleeve sections of that pipe? Or how would you do that for the short term?
Senator, yes, both of those. We would, depending on the size of the defects we found, we would either temporarily sleeve them or permanently clamp them. That would be an engineering judgment as to which one would be done. And we would expect those engineering solutions to last until we could replace the line.
Okay, so is your no intent to shut it down, just for the record, to shut it down until you get it all replaced?
No.
That would not be our intention. We are going to use a combination of techniques. If we found damage that is irreparable, as we have done with the GC2 line, in that case, we've been able to utilize a 24-inch bypass line. And that's another piece of work that I didn't mention that we are pursuing to look at what other bypass alternatives are there. And we haven't completed that piece of work yet. So that is something else that would allow us to potentially bring back some of the production from certain locations if those bypasses do exist.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In an effort to, on a personal level, to perhaps end this meeting on a positive note, Bob, it's nice to see you again. We've missed you. and glad to see you back, even under difficult circumstances. And I think, as the committee knows, perhaps not too many people in the room, but for the last couple of weeks, your son Michael has been with us shadowing Senator Bundy. And we just want to, in spite of that, we just want to tell you what a good job he did, and it was a joy having him here. You've done a fine job, and we wish him well as he pursues his career and college degree in Texas. So thanks for letting him spend some time with us. We enjoyed him.
Thank you, Senator.
Additional questions? Not, this will end the hearing. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming. We appreciate your time and look forward to seeing you again next week when we have further information.
Cool.
We'll be back with the regular committee meeting in about 5 minutes.
One more time.
That sounded good. Call the meeting back to order. The before you, each one of you should have a copy of CS for House Bill number 3001, Finance, with the backslash P, PAPA, across the top. That is our working document. Is Robin, welcome to the back to the committee. I see you've been picked out to stand up there all by yourself and to present this bill.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. For the record, my name is Robin Wilson. I'm the tax director for the Department of Revenue. Today I would like to walk you through the House CS for HB 3001. This is the version P that was passed out of the House yesterday, I believe, finally. What I will do is kind of walk you through the bill and explain kind of overall its approach. I believe Mr. Dickinson will follow with a presentation specifically about the tax rate function. And then I believe Dr. Van Muris will be following up after Mr. Dickinson. I do very much apologize that you do not have a current matrix in front of you. You will get it shortly. And you will also sort of get a roadmap for the bill. So I'd like to start off by just generally saying that this bill does five things that I'd like to draw your attention to. One, it has a variable rate that depends on investment per barrel. The second thing it does is it provides for, because it's a variable rate, a monthly calculation of the tax rate is not practical, so this moves to an annual tax return filing with monthly installment or estimated tax payments, if you will, to ensure consistent cash flow. But you will see, if you compare this to the conference committee version of the bill, you'll just see a number of places where it's changed from the word monthly to a calendar year. And that's the purpose there. The next thing it does is that, if you'll recall, Section 160 in particular grew through committee action and became sort of unwieldy. And so the drafter has taken this opportunity then to break that up a little bit into three sections to provide a bill that is more user-friendly, and certainly down the road taxpayers can find things easier. So what was Section 160 is broken up now into three sections, and those sections are 160, which provides the basic production tax value framework. 165 is where the lease expenditures allowed and disallowed is in this bill. And then what is now 170 are the adjustments to lease expenditures, which, if you'll recall, there are certain adjustments that need to be made, for example, when there's a sale of an asset. So that breaks up 160. There's also been some reordering. For example, you'll recall that the CAPEX credits were in section 024 of the bill, whereas the new area development credit and the base allowance credit were in 170 previously. The reason they were there is because it started out as a deduction. So as the bill evolved, some of just the layout of the bill didn't make a lot of sense from a drafter's perspective, so some of those sections have been simply reordered. So you will now find all the credits in sections 023, 024, and 025. And as I walk through the bill, I'll draw your attention to, you know, where it was and where it is now. So there's been that reordering. The fourth item I'd like to draw your attention to is that you'll find there's been some clarification language inserted here and there, I think, to make the bill a much more clear bill. For example, in 160, there had been questions about the interplay of operating agreements and disallowed items. I think you'll find that that language is more clear now. And there were also questions about overhead allowance, and I believe that has been clarified as to intent. Intention has not changed. It's simply been, you know, paragraphs added, words added, to make it more clear as to what the intention was all along. Perhaps the most important thing that this does is you'll recall in section 180, there was a section that required certain reports from Department of Revenue. And the way those sort of evolved was as different parts of the bill came into being during committee action, for example, a reduced tax rate on the private royalties. It was thought prudent to add a little requirement for the Department of Revenue to provide a report on those reduced tax rates for private royalties. In this version of the bill, those responsibilities have been greatly expanded. So rather than have a couple of very small reports to do on a couple of isolated aspects of the law, Section 180 now requires a comprehensive report from the Department of Revenue on the entire chapter, paying particular attention to tax rates and the investment credits and so on. So I would really draw your attention as I go through to that section. And the other thing is, as originally drafted, Section 180 required those two reports at two or three different points in time. For example, I believe we had a report due in 2013 and 2015. All of that has been now, again, coalesced into one large report that will be due the first day of the legislative session in 2011. So with that, at your pleasure, I would like to start walking through the bill.
Do that. All right. Any questions at this point? Seeing none, go ahead.
Okay. The first two pages of the bill, you will not see any differences between that and the conference committee section or conference committee bill. Let's turn to page 3, and that's really where the core of the bill lies. This is section 5 of the bill, starting on line 4 of page 3, and it actually goes on the section that deals with the variable tax rate goes on to page 4, line 25. So that's really the new language. If you'll recall, the conference committee bill had a base tax rate of 22.8%. That was before progressivity. This bill provides that the tax rate will depend on the level of investment. So you see in subsection F, then if the investment is equal to or less than $1 per BTU equivalent barrel, the tax rate will be 25%. That is found on line 16 of page 3. And then moving down there, if it's equal to or greater than $6 per BTU equivalent barrel, the tax rate shall be 20%. And C provides then for investment between $1 and $6. And that is per BTU equivalent barrel.
Senator Stedman.
Just as a kind of a procedural question, do you want her to do the overview of the bill and then go into questions, or do you want us to take sections at a time, or how do you want to work?
I think if there are, let's just cruise through it one time on the surface, and then come back in. Just we won't get into an in-depth discussion. Maybe Robin, if we just first cruise through it and what the sections approach, we'll get into a little more in-depth as we go forward.
Okay.
How would that be?
So again, subsection F is the variable tax rate.
We'll get into an in-depth discussion on that, I'm sure.
Yes, and I believe Mr. Dickinson has a specific presentation on the tax rate and its effect at different prices and different amounts. So not to steal his thunder, I'm just kind of going basically through it and,
sure,
and leave the presentation to him.
Thank you.
I would, though, like to also, in that subsection, I'm looking now at page 4. Line 12. Now, some of the discussion around an investment-based tax rate, variable tax rate, there was much concern voiced about the potentiality of gold plating. And the question there is, well, do the tax benefits of the $1 of capital investment, is that in excess of the $1 investment? So this bill contains sort of a provision to take care of that. If you look at line 12, that's a big, long equation. What the equation says is that if the tax benefits are in excess of 75% of the capital investment, then that buying down of the tax rate will be limited. That's the overall plan of line 12. If I could just spend a moment on that equation, although it looks kind of scary, what it says is there's basically four important pieces of tax benefits that would accrue to the producer for a capital investment. And the first obvious one is that there's a deduction provided for in this bill, so there's a tax benefit received because there's a tax deduction. And that is actually taken care of in the first element there in parens.
Say that again.
Yes, the first first items in paren, that is the equivalent of the tax benefit received because there is a tax deduction for the capital investment. So that's one benefit. The second principal benefit is there's a capital investment credit. There's a CapEx credit. And in this bill, it's still at 20%, so that would be the second item there in that equation. The third measurable benefit is that with the CapEx, given this tax plan, the producer is realizing a benefit because he can buy down his tax rate. And so that third one that starts with 0.25 minus R, that takes into account the buy down of the rate, that tax benefit. Now, at the same time, there's also been discussion about any of these tax benefits that change the production tax payable. Only a certain amount really is borne by the producer because a certain amount comes off the federal taxable income. So when we talk about the benefit of buying down the tax rate, we also have to factor in the federal benefit, and so that also isn't taken into account in this equation.
And which factor here is that one?
Yes, right in the middle it says bracket paren 0.25 minus R times PT, so that is the piece that talks about the buy down, then
yep,
times 1 minus IR, that is the highest federal tax rate.
Okay.
Yes.
Thanks.
The last major piece there is the federal tax deduction itself, because if there is a CapEx investment that's being made, not only will the producer be able to deduct that from the production tax value for this tax, The producer can also deduct that on its federal income tax return. Now, it's not exactly a one-for-one because on the federal tax return, it'll be depreciated over a number of years. But the sponsors of the bill felt that these were the four key pieces. There's a couple of other things that are not in this equation. For example, the state income tax benefit when it's written off of the state taxable income for corporate income tax purposes. But I would just remind people that that is, it's a worldwide calculation based on an apportionment percentage. So the impact for state corporate income taxes is fairly small. The sponsors felt that these were the four main benefits, and that's the reason that that was taken into account in this formula. The other thing I would like to note is, based on drafting, this is not the perfect drafting. It should be an equation that is solving for R. But if you'll recall sort of high school algebra, which I have a hard time remembering, you're going to turn this into a pretty complex quadratic formula. And so it was felt that an economist or an accountant looking at this equation the way it is, it's fairly easy to pick out, oh, this is the tax credit piece, this is the federal deduction piece. Whereas when it's turned into that formula, into a quadratic formula solving for R, those pieces are indistinguishable. We anticipate, should this bill pass, that the actual quadratic formula will be contained in regulations. But this is, there's one answer for that. So that's sort of the background on the equation that's in line 12. Okay, moving on then down to subsection G at line 26. This is the progressivity piece. And flipping over then to page 5, line 2, you'll see that the slope for that calculation is 0.25. That's on line 2. And the so-called trigger, that is the price at which the progressivity kicks in, and that is the net production tax value per barrel, kicks in at 40, which is on line 9. And I believe on the conference committee, just to compare things then, that was a trigger of $35 net with a slope of 0.175%. So there's a difference there. The other difference here that I'd like to point out, you'll see on line 6 of that page that the progressivity tax shall not exceed 25%. And I would just remind everyone that in the conference committee what you saw was a combined rate of 50%. So in the conference committee you added up the basic tax rate plus the progressivity could not exceed 25%. This bill, because the base tax rate would be variable based on investment, then the sponsors chose to cap the progressivity tax at 25%. So the base tax is variable. It can move between 20 and 25%, just between those parameters. And the progressivity tax is on top of that, and the progressivity itself cannot exceed 25%. So that is, that's a difference to notice between the two bills.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dyson.
So the progressivity can't exceed an additional 25%, or?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, that is correct. So the maximum base rate is 25%. In addition to the progressivity, if applicable, then that progressivity can provide an additional 25% on top of that.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Robin.
Yes. Moving then down to line 14, this is subsection I. This is deals with the tax rate for private royalties. And so if you look back to previous versions, just for comparison's sake, you would find the private royalty rates at 011F previously. So it's just been moved. It's been reordered so that all of the two subsections here that deal with the calculation of the base tax rate are together. The progressivity subsections are together, and to make a little more readable. So I would just note that 011 has been reordered a little bit, but you still see the same basic pieces. Okay. Moving down then, at the bottom of page 5, we see subsection J. And what that is, the Cook Inlet Gas ELF provision. So this bill maintains the Cook Inlet ELF provisions for both Cook Inlet Gas and Cook Inlet Oil that were in the conference committee. And just to remind how that works, the tax is calculated using the basic tax rules for the production tax value generated by Cook Inlet Gas and Cook Inlet Oil. And then that result is compared to the ELF result for those two things, and the tax is the lower of. So there is basically a ELF ceiling for Cook Inlet Gas and Oil, the very same language that was in the conference committee, but it shows up in a different subsection, still within 011. On page 6, I would just note that lines 6 through 8, that is some new language that was added just to clarify how the calculation is made for the comparison. And you'll see that very same language on lines 25 through 27. That's just been a clarifying improvement. Does not change the purpose or function of the Cook Inlet Gas or Oil. Subsection K there that starts at line 17 is the Cook Inlet Oil section. Moving on then to page 7. I'm looking at lines 5 through 9. This is a new subsection here. And the only purpose it serves is that in the previous bill, where there was a potential tax reduction for Cook Inlet Oil or gas, that is the ELF ceiling, it was not clear how that tax reduction would be accomplished. And the reason that's important is because the base tax rate could utilize CapEx credit against that base tax rate, but could not use those credits against the progressivity tax. And so that was this is clarifying language as to the order of the reduction. Okay, moving on then. The next important section I'd like to draw your attention to is it starts on page 8. It starts on line 27. It's a fairly long section, but what it says, it gives the rules for the so-called estimated tax payments, or I believe they're called in here installment payments. You will also notice that that the safe harbor provision is gone. So the way this works is that monthly estimated tax payments are made. The producer may overpay or underpay. You know, these things are not quite a science yet. But the key element here is that the federal interest rate will apply both ways. And I'll point out the interest provisions as we go along, but I would just note that 020A sets out the rules for how the estimated tax payments are calculated. Moving on then, page 11, and I'm looking starting at line 17, subsection G. This is the provision that talks about the interest that applies on the unpaid, overpaid, or underpaid estimated tax or installment payments. And it is with reference to IRC 6621 and 6622. These rates are set quarterly by the IRS, by the Treasury Department, and they are publicized. There is a fairly robust rate for underpayments. The rate for overpayments is quite a bit less, but these are rules that the producers are very familiar with. And I would just sort of contrast, the rates are less than our statutory rate, which is now over 11%. So the way this works is if there's an estimated or installment payment due, and let's say it's underpaid, then the interest will run from the date of that payment due date, i.e. the end of the next month, until March 31. On March 31, the true-up happens, and at that point, let us say that the underpayment is still there, then that becomes an addition to tax, and so at that point, the federal interest rate stops, and our state statutory rate kicks in, again at 11.25% at this point. So G deals with underpayments of tax, and H deals with overpayments of tax. And so rather than the 95% safe harbor with interest that just went one way, the sponsors felt that this would be more fair both ways, and we'll get the interest on that. And I believe the current interest rate federally for underpayments is about 10%. Okay, moving on then to page 13. I'm looking at starting on line 16, and you'll recall that I mentioned a few minutes ago that the credit section order has changed a little bit. So what you see there at 023A are the CAPEX credits. I don't believe there have been any changes to that, except that, again, it's been moved. So what was 024 is now 023. I would just note that on line 24 there, you see that the CAPEX credit is still at 20%. On the next page, line 14.
Page 14.
We're now on page 13, line 14. That is the subsection that deals with the losses. If you'll recall, if there's a loss, it can be converted to a credit that's carried forward in the next year. And generally, the way that I believe that was intended is it is carried forward based on the tax rate. Now, at this point, we have a variable tax rate. The sponsors felt that 20 was the appropriate tax rate to bring that loss forward. So all that 023 is about the CAPEX credits. And if you flip over then to page 15, starting on line 26, that is where the transitional investment credit language starts. So what is in 023 are the transferable tax credits. Moving on then to page 17, where you see starting on line 23, additional non-transferable tax credits. These were the tax credits that were in 170. So again, this is just a function of reordering the sections. And so 024A is the new area development credit. Again, it's the same language from the conference committee bill, except that it reflects a calendar year here on line 28. You see that the credit is available at $6 million. That is the annual amount. As compared to the conference committee, which was monthly, and so it said $500,000 per month. So the only change here is just the change from a monthly to an annual tax. Moving on then to page 18. Starting on line 8, that is the base allowance credit, the $12 million credit. This was also in the previous bill in section 170. It has been moved into the credit section where it properly is. And that is based on, it's the small producer credit of $12 million, which you find on line 17, based on production. Okay, 025 is still the expiration credit, so there have been no changes on that. And that's a number of pages. I'd like then to draw your attention on page 25. And I'm looking at section 160 that starts on line 22. And if you'll recall in the previous bill, and this bill maintains that structure, there are basically four areas of the state, if you will. The North Slope, the area south of the Brooks Range that is not the Cook Inlet, so that would be sort of new area development. And then we have Cook Inlet oil and Cook Inlet gas. The reason I refer to four areas is because they are treated slightly differently. They have special rules. If you'll recall, the new area that is south of the Brooks Range, that's not Cook Inlet, that enjoys the new area development credit. Cook Inlet oil and Cook Inlet gas have an ELF ceiling. So that's why I refer to four areas. This maintains those four areas, but now that the drafter has broken up section 160, there's room to spread it out a little bit so you can see pretty clearly under 160, we have one, and we have A, which is the North Slope. Going on to the next page, paragraph B, I'm sorry, subparagraph B, that is areas outside of the North Slope, other than Cook Inlet. And then C and D deal with Cook Inlet oil and Cook Inlet gas, respectively. So I think that you'll find that's a little bit easier to use. The other change that is in that section I would just note is, I'm looking now at page 25, lines 25 through 31. If you look at the conference committee language, it said oil and gas produced during, produced from a lease or property in the state. And then against that, the producer could take expenditures regarding that lease or property in the state, suggesting that somehow the bill was requiring individual accounting lease by lease by lease of the production tax value, and that was never the intention. So language has been changed here. It now says from leases or properties, and you'll find that on line 25 and line 28. So that is the change there, just to clarify that it's sort of slope-wide for that. And then turning over to page 26, the very same change you will find at the end of line 1 and 7, because the new area development credit then is applicable to those. I would note that subparagraph C and D, dealing with Cook Inlet oil and Cook Inlet gas, in that instance, the ELF ceiling is property by property, so it still says from a lease or property. So that's why you will see what looks to be inconsistent language, but that is the reason. Then moving on then to line 21, the progressivity will still be calculated on a monthly basis. It will still be reported on the annual tax return, but calculated on a monthly basis. And so paragraph 2 then just says the monthly production tax value of the following four sections. So you will see the same changes that we saw up above in subparagraph A and B, i.e. from changing from a lease or property to leases or property. You will see the very same changes reflected then in paragraph 2, subparagraphs A and B. Going on then to page 28. A couple of things I'd like to draw your attention to. First, on line 20, it says, in determining whether costs are lease expenditure, the department shall consider, and then it goes on to say typical industry practices. That is a key difference from previous versions of the bill. The previous version said that substantial weight shall be given to industry practice. And the sponsors heard a fair amount of discussion about substantial weight, and so that language has been changed to say shall consider, again, in an effort to bring clarity and as to the weight that different things are given. I would note on line 23, and I believe this was in the conference committee as well, but I would just like to point it out there, that line 23 says that the department shall consider industry practices other than the items listed in E of this section. That's a very important phrase right there on line 23. What that says is that whatever industry practices are, if it's a prohibited expense on this next list, it's prohibited. So that, I think, is an item of clarity. And then on to page 29, you will see the same language on line 25. Again, other than items listed in E of this section. E is the prohibited expenditures, prohibited deductions, if you will. Moving on then to page 30. I'm looking here at line 8, and this has to do with the overhead allowance. And there was, again, what the previous bill said was an overhead allowance, I believe is the way it was worded, and there was quite a bit of discussion about what that meant. And the intention was always to provide a percentage of the direct costs. This, so that has been clarified on line 8. It says a reasonable percentage should be allowed for overhead, but it's a reasonable percentage of the costs that are allowable, basically. So if you would take a look at that paragraph and the same clarification is found at the very top of page 31, line 1, a reasonable percentage. Then moving on to line 6, this is subsection E, which is the list of disallowed expenditures. And that list, I believe it's the very same list that was in the conference committee. And then moving on, the next item that I'd like to draw your attention to is on page 35. And this is the section that I referred to earlier as section 180. This is the section that requires the Department of Revenue to prepare a report which is due the first day of the 2011 regular session, and you find that date at line 25. But you'll see if you read paragraph 1 and 2 that this is quite an expanded responsibility of reporting. It says the effects of the provisions of this chapter on exploration, development, and production, on investment expenditures, and so on, paying particular attention, and that's on line 18, to the tax rates, tax credits, deductions for, and adjustments to lease expenditures. So this is, I think, an important section to review carefully. Moving on then to page 36, and I have not pointed out each word change relative to the change from monthly filing to annual filing, but I would just note on page 36, lines 9 and 10, this has to do with the spill fees, and it just clarifies that those are due then on March 31, as is lines 27 and 28. And the last change I would just note is on page 37, lines 27 through 31, and then it goes on two lines on the next page. This is not new language, but it is has been moved from one of the subsections to the general definitions because that BTU equivalent has been utilized now in a couple of sections. So that kind of, let me see if there's anything else here. In terms of transition, in terms of transition timing, the previous bills provided for 10 months, and under this bill, given an annual filing with the monthly estimated tax payments, it provides that for the rest of 2006 that the payments would be made under the current existing rules with true up on March 31, but that starting for the January estimated tax payment, installment payment that would be due at the end of February, then that would be under the new rules. So that's actually closer to the six-month transition period, I believe, that was in the original governor's bill and was changed during, I believe, House committee action to 10 months.
Senator Dyson.
Well done.
Thank you.
I'm always impressed at how quickly and thoroughly you seem to get a hold of this stuff. I admire that skill. Really a small point, but there's been some discussion around about not allowing the producers to have a deduction for the money they spend trying to influence the legislative process. And I understand that the federal government does not allow a deduction for political activity. First of all, is that true? And then second, in all the discussions you've been a part of, have we ever talked about not allowing those as a business expense?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, right off the top of my head, I can't tell you what the federal rule is. I can certainly come back and give you that information. In terms of this bill, I know that there was some discussion on the House floor about it, but in committee, I have not been in a committee where that has been discussed specifically. My response about whether it would be deductible is it would be, I believe, almost impossible for that to be classified as a lease expenditure, which is the very first hurdle that has to be met. If it's not a lease expenditure, it cannot be deducted. You cannot get a capital credit for it either. So, that clearly would not be an immediately allowable expenditure. Given the fact that, like at page 30 and 31, talk about a reasonable percentage of allowed costs, it would just be a percentage of direct costs. It would not be, oh, here's a lobbying expense and it's allowable or not allowed. It is part of the overhead. Does that fully answer your question?
I think so. It's U.S. 26 U.S. Code 162E that.
Okay.
And for some reason, the Fed seemed interested in spelling it out, but I don't know that they have the clarifying hurdle of the lease expenditure.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking at page 28, lines 12. Lease expenditures, ordinary and necessary costs upstream of the point of production of oil are incurred there and so on. Typical industry practices in the state determine the cost of those items. I don't know either. Maybe Dan, do you have an answer?
Mr. Seekins, through the chair, Dan Dickinson. Chairman Seekins, excuse me. I don't have a direct. I mean, I think what's laid out here is you would not typically see that as an ordinary necessary cost or direct cost, and then I believe that the test that I would have to go and follow up on Senator Dyson's question to see is if the feds disallow it, do they disallow it? Do they say, yes, it's ordinary and necessary, but there's a special disallowance for it, or do they simply say it's not ordinary and necessary? Yeah. And that would test whether that test was another filter on it. But I believe the direct cost filter that Director Wilson mentioned a minute ago is really the is the one that sort of conceptually, it's none of those kinds of costs would be allowed as direct costs.
Thank you.
Senator Stebbins, you had earlier questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just was going to wait until we go through the formula. I'm just kind of curious on the tax formula how some of the offsets work.
The questions are as to the presentation we've seen so far. Seeing none, Mr. Dickinson, it appears to me you're next on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I actually, there's a several-page presentation that I think if we could get that handed out, that would probably make make all the algebra I'm going to run through a lot more fun. Just kidding.
Let's take a short recess to get the material handed out. Call the meeting back to order. The chair would like to recognize and welcome Representative Kelly to the audience. Are we, Mr. Dickinson, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I'd like to speak about today is just the tax rate. Director Wilson went over many aspects of this bill. I'm going to focus on just how you determine the tax rate in this bill, and it's always going to be a number between 20% and 25%. Talk about some of the effects. I'll talk about progressivity a little bit, but I really want to focus in on the fact there's some fairly complex algebra, some fairly complex steps in here, but it's all buffered by this fact. Sometimes this formula was compared to ELF as being complex. One of the major differences I would point out is the ELF can drive you to zero. This can only drive you down to 20%. So I'm going to repeat it for a third time and probably a couple more times in the presentation. The outcome of this is a number between 20% and 25%. One of the reasons when the sponsors came and spoke to me about a mechanism here is they said, gosh, you know, we've had it, you know, the governor suggested 20, and they had one committee at a 21.5 and a 22.5 and a 22.8. And so there have been a number of different numbers suggested as being appropriate. We've done a lot of analysis. The lines all fall fairly close together when you look at the revenue effects. They really aren't so much the investment-driven effects. And so the question is there a better way of getting at the number? And what you have in front of you is a suggestion that says, yeah, the way you get at the tax rate is you look at the amount of investment a company's making. And that's the first step. And now there's some problems with that. We'll get to those later. But let me just walk through the very simple idea. If you look at this first table, there's really three columns, but you really only have to look at two columns. And on the left-hand column says, how much of an investment are you making per barrel? And the per barrel really is just to scale things. So, you know, we really have three big companies, but even among those companies, one produces about twice as much oil as the other. So we say, how much per barrel investment are you making? And if the answer is zero, the upper left-hand corner, then your tax rate is 25%, and that's the upper right-hand corner. As you increase your investment up to a dollar, you still don't get any tax relief. And the point is, there is a basic amount that has to be spent every year in capital. Sometimes you hear the phrase LTO, or license to operate. It's the stuff you need for health and safety, just the fundamental mechanics of stuff you're putting in that you can capitalize under the federal tax system. And so for that first dollar, you do not get any benefit. Your tax rate remains at 25%. But at that point, as you increase your spending, your per barrel spending, your tax rate goes down. And this is set up with a fairly simple mathematic relationship. So if you go from $1 to $2, your tax rate falls from 25% down to 24%. You spend an additional dollar per barrel, gets you up to around $3. Your tax rate has fallen to 23%. You go up to $4, it's fallen to 22%. And if you go to $5, 21, and at $6, you hit the floor of 20%. And as you spend additional and drive your dollar per barrel up, you get no further tax relief. So again, the fundamental idea here is, as you spend between $1 and $6 a barrel, reinvest that into the North Slope or into the state, your tax rate falls. If you spend less, you're not penalized, if you will, at less than a dollar. If you spend more, you receive no tax break. A fundamental small change there that says, okay, this piece will be a variable instead of a fixed number. Now, what I'd like to do is just walk you through how that works and then show how that's going to interact with some of the other pieces. So I've got what's called a five-step calculation. It's the next, and turning to the next page, all this does is set up the entire sets of cases I'm going to analyze. And basically, here, very quickly, you can see the assumptions. The top row says, what's my destination? And I've run it from $20 a barrel up to $100 a barrel. And Mr. Chairman, I apologize. When this was, I was suggested that I make a presentation on a very quickly. And so I had a step in which I had plugged in last Friday's closing price. $73.46 was plugged in where $70 was because I'd done some runs. I didn't fix this back. When I was printing this out, I was printing it on two printers. So one was on something in which you had $73.46 and something you had $70. There's going to be a slight discrepancy in some of these numbers as a consequence. I apologize. I can give you a coherent set later. But just so you understand why there's two slightly different variants of this glommed together. But the point is, you start with a destination value. You subtract from that $12 in operating costs and transportation costs. And those are just the cost to get it out of the ground, cost to transport it to market. And what you see in the very dark line where it says result is what your wellhead value would be, or your production tax value would be before subtracting any capital investment. And then down the left-hand column, we see capital investment from a 0 cents per barrel all the way down to $15 a barrel. And I just would remind you that the capital expenditures of $15 a barrel under current production of roughly 300 million barrels would be almost $5 billion. So that would be a huge amount of capital expenditure compared to where we are today. Again, all you're seeing here, and let's just take an example, at $40 a barrel, I subtract 12, that brings me to 28 for a result, and then you just simply say as I increase my spending by 50 cents a barrel, I march from 28 to 27 to 27.50 to 26.50 to 26.25.50 on down. So all this is setting out all the cases I'm going to analyze. If I could turn the page, on the next page, what you will see is the very simple mechanism that we just talked about. If the very top line, no matter what my price, all the way across, you will see you will see a 25% tax rate. If you go down to the bottom and the bottom, seven or eight lines, what you will see is if your investment is up in that 10 to 11 to $12 range, you're at 20%. And all you will see between those two is that you're marching down from 25, 24, 23, 21 as your investment per barrel increases. So that's a fairly simple outline, and I think people looked at it and said, that's great. The investors will get lower tax rates. The harvesters will get higher tax rates. But there's a huge flaw in this that has to be corrected, and that is, at very high prices, and I consider where we are today at high prices, when you start messing with the tax rate, the effect overwhelms the capital investment. And let me just give you a very quick example. I'll see if I can even do it, you know, in my head, just so we can, you know, we're spending 300 million barrels a day now. Excuse me, we're producing 300 million barrels a year. So if everybody went out and spent an additional $300 million, that would be a $1 a barrel increase. And so your tax rate would drop by 1 percentage point. Now, at $70 a barrel, that $300 million is worth over $20 billion in tax rate. Okay? And when we take 1% change, let's leave out net versus gross, let's leave out all those things, just assume for a minute that, you know, because I can multiply 7 times 3 in my head, we have this $20 billion tax rate, you change it by 1%, that's $200 million. So just by making a $300 million investment, you've gotten $200 back immediately, and that's before you've accounted for credits, federal income taxes, state income taxes, a whole host of other effects. So what you lead to is a situation that's always called gold plating. And if you do the mechanics here and if you had just done that step, you find situations where literally within the realm of numbers that were quite reasonable, somebody could spend a dollar and get back tax breaks of almost $1.80. And that is, everybody agrees, is a terrible effect because it leads to wasteful spending. It leads to, it just creates situations where you are spending money solely for the purposes of the tax break, not because it's going to increase production, not because it makes sense. So nobody thinks that gold plating, even gold plating opportunities, companies don't, I mean, they like them because they can bring their taxes down, but it just creates all kinds of bizarre behavior that they don't like to engage in either. So what we said is, okay, we're going to build a formula in that's going to make sure that gold plating doesn't occur. And if you turn to step 2, that's the calculation of R, and that says, okay, how are we going to prevent, we're going to put a formula in here that's going to give you an alternative calculation, and basically you're going to end up going you're going to have to pay a tax rate at the higher of these two calculations. So let's say I make a whole bunch of investment, drives my rate down to 25. I come here and look at this table, and because I'm getting such a huge tax benefit from spending that money, my tax rate gets pushed back up to 23 or 24%. So again, if you look at this table, what you will see is at the very top row, 25, as you might expect. Maybe we can go over and we'll just go down the $20 column. Even though in some ways it's a bizarre column, but I'll walk you through it. As you spend more, yeah, your rate falls from 25 to 24 to 22 to 19. Now at that point, this formula would no longer apply because your tax rate would be 20. One of the interesting to me things, and all of you who are algebraists will notice, you run down to a negative 107% and flip over to a number, a positive 157, and there's what really happens here is in the denominator, there's a piece of the formula. You have to subtract your capital investment from your tax base. And if those two are equal, you get zero. Zero in the denominator yields you, you know, this number, and on one side of it, you're very close to negative infinity, one side positive infinity. I'm telling you stuff that interests me but has no relevance to this. Once you have a floor in there between 20 and 25, you don't get these bizarre effects. My point is, this table shows you how your R is kicking in and what it's doing. If we could turn to the next page, table, and I think this is one that is really of interest. And I apologize. Obviously, my printer wasn't calibrated. There's two zones that, at least on my printer, look like they were different colors. Here, they're the same. I'm trying to make something look a little different here. What this shows you is, once you've done that comparison, that higher of 20 and 25%, what's your tax rate going to be? Again, your columns across the top are wellhead value, or excuse me, are your destination value. The rows are determined by how much investment you make. So let's start out. What we're saying is, in the very beginning, if you're not making any investment, your rate is 25. If you make about a dollar investment, your rate drops down to 24. But you know, at $100, If oil prices are $100, you don't even get, and you only make a $2 investment, you're still at 25. In other words, what you can see is, as at very high prices, you don't quite pick up the benefit quite as quickly. And I think you can sort of see the shape here. There's a period of investment, you can see at 20, that gives you the 24, 23, next color is 22. And then there's a whole slew of, there's a whole colored area beneath that, at which you are simply hitting the floor at 20. At $100 a barrel, you don't drive your tax rate down to 20% until you're roughly investing $15 a barrel, or five times what current rates are. Now, the danger is somebody finds a way to do that, or they come take their whole, I won't say London headquarters, I'll tell you what company I'm thinking about, but they take their headquarters and they'll see what they can get by us, because as they can drive it down. But that's, we'll just have to make sure that what we're looking at are the real costs. And I guess in some sense what this shows is the R factor means that at these high prices, basically folks are going to be very near in this 23, 24, 25% range. It's going to take quite a bit of spending to drive them down to the 20 and 21% range. On the other hand, if you go down to the $20 and $30 that we expect to be in, what you will see is folks can expect to be in a 20% tax rate a lot of the time.
Senator Stedman.
Dan, could, I think we've been talking about historically, there's about a little over a billion, I guess, in expenditures. And we're talking about the impact of the credit driving on capital investments. So if we doubled it, some of these numbers are pretty far out there. I mean, we've never seen an oil price at $103, and I don't think we've ever seen investments at 15. So if we went into the range of where we're at a billion, where would we be at 2 billion?
Good question, and there's a table later on that kind of shows you that. But Mr. Chair, or Senator Stedman through the chair, if you turn, for example, to the three pages in, there'll be a table like this that looks like this. And what that does is that across the top, that runs you from an investment of $400 million all the way up to $2 billion. And down the side, it says, okay, what happens for production? What happens if we're at the 90,000 barrels a day, down to 850, all the way down to 200,000 barrels a day? And it just kind of shows you what a dollar per barrel could be. So, Senator Stedman, to get to your exact question, if in the next couple of years at current production we in fact went up to 2 billion, you can see over here that's really in the $6 a barrel range. So then you can take that and plug that back into the chart we were just looking at and say, gosh, if I stay in the $6 per barrel range, under $50, that'll be a 20% tax rate. At $100 a barrel, that will put me in the 23 to 24% tax rate.
Senator Elton.
Well, I was just going to make a quick comment. I think when we get into this, one of the things I'm going to be interested in looking at is the comparison of this proposal versus just a flat 22.5% tax rate. And the benefits to the state of the simplicity of that versus the complexity of this. And it looks to me like that under that $6 scenario, 22.5% tax rate that we're looking at falls right in the middle.
Thank you. Senator Sherman, I can also, if you want to see, I mean, I can print these out with another decimal place showing if you want to try to identify exactly where the 22.5 is.
Well, no, I'm just saying, Mr. Chairman, I think
the
concept forms, I mean, we spent a lot of time on several versions of the bill dealing with, different rates versus the sliding scale. I think one of the points that we have to deal with is a sliding scale. The complexity of the sliding scale worth the political issues that come with it.
Okay.
political questions, I won't answer it.
Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Dan, just so that I understand, I think your second chart in your presentation, you show cost minus operating expenses. And then in the colored chart here, I'm assuming that this is just the value of a barrel of oil.
Again, in the Senator Elton, through the chair, this is the percentage that would flow from the mechanics of the formula. So you would have, if you had a $50 destination value and $8 investment, you'd look here and you'd say, okay, my tax rate is 20.
Okay, so you, these are unadjusted. You're not taking out the $12 like you did before. Am I still missing a point here?
That's correct. I mean, you're taking them out. When you then go to apply this, it will have taken those out. But that is not part of the calculation here. That's correct.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
You, Senator Dyson.
Dan, I want to ask you kind of the same question I asked you the other day. By and large, is the administration comfortable with this approach, and or do they feel like they can negotiate it with the administration? I see Commissioner Corbis is here. If you'd prefer, I can ask him.
Commissioner, would you prefer to answer that question?
Mr. Commissioner?
Here, Robin, you can sit over in the corner.
I'm sorry I was otherwise focused on another issue.
Well, I'm used to being ignored.
Go ahead, Ms. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, it's perhaps an unfair question, but an immense amount of work has gone into this, and it looks to me like there's some really genius parts to it, and the concept. Can you say how the administration views this, and how you and the governor feel about being able to negotiate this kind of a scheme with the producers?
The administration, through the chair, Senator Dyson, the administration is supporting the its original 2020 statute. I don't know how the administration will address this.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Other questions? Seeing none, at this point, is there discussion, Senator Wilkin? Are you finished?
No, I had a couple more pages, if I might, Mr. Chairman. Sorry. Sorry to disappoint you there.
I wasn't sure if you were finished or not.
Okay. Well, as you can say, this is a five-step calculation. We're on step three. So the next step does step a little bit out. I said I would talk about the difference between 25 and 20%. This next page steps outside of that and says, using a 2.5%, excuse me, yes, it's the page after the colored page. It says step four. And step four simply adds in progressivity.
Wait a minute.
So
the one after I've got. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Step four.
These were mechanically assembled. One on a black and white printer. One in color. So they may be a little bit out of order on someone's individuals. But step four.
0025 at 40.
Exactly, and that is what I think Director Wilson explained earlier. Now, and if you look here, what you'll see is at $50 and below, progressivity brings in zero because remember I'm subtracting an assumed OPEX and transportation of $12. So clearly, 50 minus 12 always takes you below 40. As you might expect, at $60, you can literally see that when you hit the $8 capital expenditure, you hit zero because 60 minus 12 minus 8 gets you down to the 40. But at any price above that, or any wellhead, because you're subtracting capital above that, you can see there is progressivity. And again, I apologize. The two things that jump out with extra decimal places, we're simply trying to do an illustration for someone of the kind of rates you would see today, so that you would see an added progressivity of about 3.5 percentage points. At $80, you go much higher. 90, you go much higher. And Mr. Chairman, if you go to the next step, step five, what you will see is the net effect of the rate mechanism between 20 and 25 and the progressivity. The upper right-hand corner says, gosh, if we go to $100 a barrel and you're not making any investments, you're paying at 37%. The lower left-hand corner says, if you are, you know, if we go down to $20 a barrel and you're making a huge investment, anything over about $3.50, you are simply down to the 20% rate. So, again, I think folks may want to spend some time, or you can look through all these various ways of looking at all these various numbers. There's a lot of numbers here, but I think you'll very quickly see sort of the patterns and how you go from a high number in the upper right-hand corner to a low number in the lower left-hand corner. I have a couple more slides here that I would like to run through. The next one, I apologize, it would look a whole lot better in color, but it's sort of...
Just a second, Senator.
Certainly.
Bundy has a question.
Index this at current rate of investment and current prices, say under 70, if this were in effect, what would be the tax rate?
Senator Bundy, the very last thing I'm going to go through is an example at today's price and today's investments. Actually, excuse me, Friday's price and today's investments. I understand that with BP's dramatic announcement, our $73 now looks like a low price, so we'll go from there. But one of the next questions, or one of the next the item illustrated here next is what happens on a dollar per barrel amount. And one of the weaknesses of this system is obviously what we're focusing on is the numerator, increasing volumes in the numerator. But you can also look at the denominator, and if you decrease volumes in the denominator, you can have that same effect. And so one of the illustrations here that I wanted to show was what kind of relationship do you tend to see or could you see for this wide range of dollars investment and this wide range of investments. And I think what you can't see with the color, but it's fairly dramatic, I think if you look at the numbers, you'll see it. About the entire right-hand side, or the lower right-hand side of this, is always brings you out to 20%. Excuse me, this chart right here. And basically, the lower right-hand quadrant, everything here you'll see is above the $6, would bring you down, and you'd hit that lower end. And so if, in fact, as prices... If we have a fall in volumes as we are forecasting, but there is also an increase in production, you will have people driving their rates down to 20. And again, the shaded this does not include the anti gold plating break. If I might turn to the next page, and this gives you some actual numbers, and one of the effects, of course, that's going to happen is so far everything I've modeled or everything I've talked about with my 300 million barrel example is the entire North Slope. But as you well know, the North Slope is not a single taxpayer. There are different taxpayers there. What we're taking here, some numbers were actually presented to you earlier by ConocoPhillips. They line up fairly closely with some numbers we developed, so I decided to use the ones that are already in the record here. And basically just looks at the three major producers and says, what kind of cents per barrel have we seen over the last 5 years? You can look, BP, for example, ranges from a high of $5 down to a low of around $2. ConocoPhillips, a high of $5 to a low of about $2.50. And those are ExxonMobil from a low of about $2 to a high of about $3. The others, you tend to get very high notions here, but that's because a lot of those others are folks who are just investing. I mean, I think there's the Kerr McGee, Anadarko, who's doing the developments out further west, Pioneer in some of those numbers. The final box then says, what happens if I combine all that data? You've heard us mention, used several times, use a $3.50 average figure for production, excuse me, for dollar per barrel investment. And if you look in the lower right-hand corner, that actually mechanically here is $3.419, but that's kind of where we've gotten that figure that we've used. But what you can see here is if you think about that sort of dollar difference, a dollar making a percentage point difference, if you look at the average, you will see BP is about at $3, so they would be able to knock two of those, because remember the first dollar doesn't count, they'd be able to knock $2 down, so they'd probably go from a 25 down to something in the 23 range. ConocoPhillips is more 380, I'm going to call it 4 so I can do it in my head, knock off the $1, so they'd go from 25 down to about 22. Exxon is about $2, so you'd knock off 1, so they'd go from about $25 down to about 25% down to about 24%, and the others you would typically find at a 20% or the lowest rate because you're well over the $6 per barrel amount.
Go ahead, Senator Stebbins.
Clear up a little bit how it works year by year. In other words, the benchmark starting point of year 2, year 3, as they roll along?
Senator Stebbins, through the chair, it would essentially reset every year. So, I mean, if you had an amount spent, it would be the total capital for that year divided through by the production, and that would establish it. And so if you had a two-year building program to bring something online, you'd show a great, you know, you could drive your rate down during those 2 years. Let's just remember the floor is 20, you drive it down to 20. And then as soon as you are producing from that, you would have the effect of, but you weren't spending as much anymore. Obviously, you'd be spending a little because you usually have, once you've got a program up and running, there's going to be some kind of ongoing capital. But you'll see your rate go back up again. So, I mean, to put it another way, I mean, one of the weaknesses of this is you're imposing a heavier tax rate on the thing you want to encourage. In other words, if you've got tons and tons of volume and did it simply maintaining the same level of capital, you would drive to it towards a 25% rate. So does that answer your question, sir?
That's one of the concerns I have, and one of them is kind of a curiosity to see why when this was set up, it wasn't set starting at, for instance, $1 billion, which is roughly what they've done. And why would we credit them the first $1 billion when actually what we're trying to do is get to the $2 billion mark, not to the $800 million mark?
Senator Stebbins, through the chair, I mean, it really did start at the $1 billion. If you think of 300 million barrels divided through by $1,050,000,000, that brings you out to 350, which comes out to a peg of 22.5%. Because 350 minus that $1 you have to spend brings you down to 250. 250, you know, 2.5 from 25 brings you down to 22.5. So, should I go through that more slowly?
No.
Okay. So, in a sense, this was pegged at that sense of that. 5-year average of 350 to say, if we maintain 350, then we would maintain a 22.5%. And of course, it's an average, and again, some will be higher, some will be lower.
Right. So in 05, we just look at the expenses in 05. It was almost $1.2 billion. We'll look back down here in the summary 05.
Mm-hmm.
105. And then. Take their each of these four groups and you weight them out for that particular year. And I recognize every year is a little different. Mm-hmm. If you do, you know, a 5-year rolling average, whatever you can do. But basically, that comes out to about an average tax of 21.7. Does that seem about right?
You
pick one year, like 05, where you can pick any year you want.
Okay. That's correct. So you would take 344, you'd knock a dollar off it, so you'd be at 244, and so that would come out to actually 2005 would come out very close to the same thing, about 2.5. Because your average is very close to $3.50 a barrel. It's, you know, $3.43 a barrel. 2006, you're right. That 2006, you drive down about a percentage point lower as a consequence of that additional spending.
So then the tax rate in 06 then would be what?
Senator Stebbins, through the chair, let's take 4.6 and round it to 4.5. The average would then be 21.5 across all producers. But again, you know, what that would really look at, you can see that, for example, in 2006, ConocoPhillips was spending on average $2 a barrel more than either BP or Exxon. So again, it would be different for different players.
We could weight these by their market share and get, like you're talking about, a fairly close estimate on their average tax for all four entities here. And that's roughly 21.5% ballpark. So isn't this tax actually, rather than a sliding scale of 25 to 20, isn't it for like 06 or 21.5% tax with an opportunity to increase expenditures above where they are today to drive it to 20?
Senator Stedman, through the chair, if you go to the table that also incorporates the anti gold plating effect, you will see that that in fact does push up, at the 450 and 73.40, and current prices, you are it rounds to 23 there, but I believe you'll see it is in the 22.5 range.
So just as a ballpark number, just use 23.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, I'd have between 22. It, obviously, the rounding at someplace between 22.5 and 23.49.
Mr. Chairman, I'm more interested in the concept than trying to write it down. And then you swing your 20% credit center, whatever it happens to be. We won't know that, Billy. Swing the credits and take the 23 down to some other number. And then,
Senator Stedman, if I might, the credits won't drop the tax rate once you've calculated the amount you'd apply it. So I think the other intermediate step that's important to recall there is you'd add almost another 4% for progressivity. Right. And there is an example that walks through all these numbers. It gives us an example, and perhaps that would be the thing to do. If we move on to the next page, which is a table like this.
I had a couple of questions first.
Oh, excuse me.
I'm all right on this.
Okay.
This is where I have the question.
Senator Ellsman.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Dan, before we move to the next page, I'm going to make an assumption. You can tell me whether that assumption is correct. If you look at the BP box, mm-hmm. They average over the last 5 years 2.908. Their capital investment averages 350. Given the current events, I'm going to assume that 2007 we may see a large increase, and I'm assuming that those capital expenditures, the additional capital expenditures, would help with their tax rate and would bring it down from 23 to maybe 22.5. We are going to see their tax rate driven down if, in fact, this formula is adopted. Is that correct?
Senator Ellsman, if this formula is adopted, then within certain limits, increased expenditure will drive your tax rate down. I guess one of the things, I almost hesitate to do this because right now we don't have a lot of facts in front of us. But, you know, although this could be very disruptive time-wise, simply replacing whatever it ends up being, 3 miles, 10 miles, 15 miles of pipe, may not be that expensive compared with other things. For example, 2001, they spent $600 million, almost double their average, and that was essentially the final creation of the North Star, and that was an entire unit, an island, subsea pipeline, all those kinds of things. So, I really don't want to speculate, but at least what we heard today was they're talking about replacing what I'll call standard pipe. It's sort of understood technology where you can get it, replacing several miles of that. That will be expensive. I'm not sure that it'll be more than, will it be out of the range of numbers seen here, Senator? I do not believe so, based on, a little bit of information I've seen here today.
Thanks, Mr.
Senator Stevens and Senator Wilkin.
If I interpret the way that BP is the operator of those facilities, the facilities are jointly owned, is that it do not impact one entity alone. Those expenses that would be incurred would be spread across all 100%
Senator Stevens, that's correct. In fact, one of the anomalies of Prudhoe Bay is they're a minority owner, and so Exxon and ConocoPhillips are picking up around 37 cents of each dollar spent. BP would only be picking up about 26 cents.
If it was $1 million a mile, we'd be looking at $21 million.
Senator Stevens, through the chair, I mean, it will be millions or tens of millions of dollars. I don't want to imply this is a...
No.
Right.
It was $1 million a mile, a lot of money. Senator Wilkins.
Mr. Chair, Dan, I'm trying to figure out if we look at your color chart, the scale across the top, the 23 to 100, what is the effect? Are those, either those axes adjusted to account for inflation, i.e. loss of buying power? I think they should be, but maybe not.
Senator Wilkin, through the chair. No. Short answer is they are not, and then the slightly more complex answer is should they be? You know, if you were trying to preserve these relationships in real time, you know, the real relationships, yes, you would. The sponsors of this bill were particularly focused on the fact that they did not want inflation on any of these markers. They believe that in general that's something that the legislature can come back and look at, and there's, I guess, a whole areas outside my expertise where you're also wrestling with those notions. But what you've correctly identified is if you said here's how it looks and we want to preserve that in real terms, that you're absolutely right. Because, I mean, one of the effects that you're going to see is, I know we've sort of gotten used to living with low inflation again, but real increases of spending and inflation would have the same effect in the formula.
Okay, so on the color chart, if I'm a taxpayer, I want to move as far to the left as I can move. That gets me in the color range. And if I started at 60, just rough math, 3% a year, that would be 10 years, that would be 30% less, so that would be $18, so that would be down 10 years from now, that in real dollars, we would really be operating in the $40 pump, which obviously moves over. Then the other piece, I guess, that bothers me is that while that's not being adjusted, the left column is being adjusted because that's the result of inflation of investment. So really, we're doing two things. It's a lever, really. While this one goes down a little each year with decreased buying power, this one is being recognized with increased buying power, and so it moves you to the left further. So that's I got my question.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, kind of attendant to that, on step two, is it better to have, I can't figure out from the formula, is it better to have a high R or a low R?
As Senator Wilkin, through the chair, I think as you correctly identified a moment ago, the tax man would like a high R, the taxpayer would like a low R. R is just simply saying the percentage as it comes in that formula.
So looking at your chart, again, if I'm a taxpayer, I want to be moving to the left.
Correct. But again, Senator Wilkin, just to make the observation, if I look in the lower left-hand corner here, I'm at 37%, whereas in the upper right-hand corner, I'm at 25. But that's because the words of the statute say, if you're in the situation where this 37 is generated, you go down to 20. Because in this situation, you can just think about this, if I have a $20 destination value, and I subtract $12 in operating costs, and $15 in capital costs, obviously I've got a negative tax base, so and in that case, wherever you are investing more than you are getting in profits, you automatically drive to 20%. And those are simply words in this statute that I think Ms. Wilson pointed out to you.
Thank you.
So if we might go on, Mr. Chairman, to the set of basically a calculation at current numbers, last Friday's close. And what I'd like to do is walk you through how the POP works, in this situation, and then there's for a quick comparison, the PPT, the governor's bill, and then the status quo is there just to help remind folks some of the differences. But we start with a value of $73.46, which you could go look up. I've assumed the $12 OPEX and transportation deduction, and then the capital is simply the 2006 estimate. And again, we can talk about how good that estimate is, but let's just, for today, we're simply using that number. So we come out with $56.83 per barrel. And then if you look over in the next column, you say, okay, as a you know, we're producing in this model, we're using roughly 300 million barrels, and so that or 262 million after you've deducted the royalty barrels, and so you generate this value of 14.9 or $15 billion in PPT taxable value. Now we have to figure out what percentage of that we're going to take. The first calculation shows how we're going to figure out the progressivity. So we take 56.83, we subtract $40 from it, so that leaves that the profitability that we're going to be putting progressivity on is $16.83. We take a quarter of that, and it comes out to an increment of 4.2%. So we're going to be adding 4% for progressivity purposes. Now, let's walk through that calculation. Our base rate is 25%, and so I take 25% of 14 billion or 15 billion, and I come out with the 3.7%. People are going to say, "Wait a minute! The royalty effect in there is why that." I'll just stop there. So, the baseline calculation is $3.7 billion taxable. Because they're making a $4.63 investment, as you say, you knock a dollar off of 4.63, you come up with 3.63, you minus 3.63% from 25, so that brings you down to 21.3, and that has the equivalent of knocking about a half a billion or $541 million out of what they're being taxed by lowering the tax rate. The next step in the calculation is we say, wait a minute, that's going to end up giving you too large a bonus, and so we're going to add back in another roughly 2 percentage points or 1.932, or we're going to add back in $288 million. The next calculation says, okay, let's look at the progressivity. Progressivity, since we're above $40 a barrel, we turn our progressivity through, and we're going to add $600 million. Yeah, you run through all of those, and you've now said, okay, the amount of tax is going to be $4.1 billion. We then go down to the credits, and again, none of those have been touched, or Robin talked about, I guess, how they're adjusted. If we in fact have $4.63, that's going to generate at the 20% rate of credit of $277 million that year. Since this is slope wide, we have in the $12 million credit for five players, I guess that would work through, or $72 million. And then the TIE in that first year, there'd be a credits worth another $139 million. You run that all through, and you would see that the tax under this bill for this year would be $3.6 billion across the slope. And just to compare that very quickly, the calculation you would do under the PPT bill that was introduced this session, you'd have a 20% tax rate on that same base, and you would have those same three credits, and the result would be about $1 billion, $1.1 billion less, or 2.5. And then if you look at the status quo, you have to make two adjustments. The first thing, you have to knock out, and I was fairly arbitrary here, I knocked out half of the operating, well, you have to knock out all the operating costs, leaving the transportation deductions. I cut that operations and OPEX and transportation number in half. That's the only subtraction you get. So your tax base under the status quo is higher at 17.7%, but the average ELF is 0.5. The average tax rate is 15%, so you're half of that. So you take 7.5% of the $17 billion. It brings you out to $1.3 billion, and of course that's where you stop. No credits, no capital investment features. So this gives you a rough comparison of how the three would line up, given some of the figures we've estimated for this year.
Senator Stedman.
I was wondering, Mr. Chairman, if we could get sort of the PPT as introduced in the special session, if we can get the PPT bill as last passed by the Senate. or the conference committee bill. Either one, I'm not too concerned about it. One of those two. And then if we could do one more calculation at the bottom, the effective tax rate after credits.
On what base, Senator Stedman?
Yes.
I mean, right, but I understand, but effective rate on net or on gross or?
Effective rate as impacted, here we're starting at 27.5, and then we throw in our credits.
We always calculate on Econ 1, I think it was effective rate on gross, wasn't it?
Right.
Okay. Okay.
So we see our effective rate so we can compare them across.
Chris, we can do that. Senator Stedman, we can do that.
Senator Wagner, then Senator Bundy.
Yeah, this is a question.
On topic?
Oh.
Can we also, government take?
Mr. Chairman, we have some of those, and I simply didn't get pulled out, and I don't think looking at them black and white is that good, but we do have those. One of the points I would make is on all of these, like, you know, what you will see is, the status quo and the governor's bill stand out, and this, if I can put it sort of crudely, kind of falls in the crowd, probably falls within the range of some of the other bills passed, in the implication that some of those further years out were well within our modeling error, but we can put those out to give you the basis of comparison, sir.
On this point?
Yeah, as long as we're piling on, Mr. Chair, it would be interesting to see these figures based on Department of Revenue projections, oil price projection, rather than just the cost of oil.
On what, Senator?
On Department of Revenue oil price projections for the next year.
And Senator, I believe you will see those in the fiscal note. You will see that has the official forecast.
Can I add one thing? When we do these, could we not get all wrapped up on what a particular price is on a particular day, because it changes by the minute? Can we just use 70, 60?
Senator,
easier numbers to manipulate back and forth so we don't have to sit.
We can extrapolate.
Right. Senator Stedman, through the chair, I appreciate that, and I typically do. This was something I did at a representative-specific request, and when I was suggested that we do a presentation here, I pulled what I had and stapled it together. But I.
Senator Wagner?
My question's kind of got to do with the gold plating correction, and that's just a percentage coming off the base rate, so that's going to exclude a lot of auditing necessity, I would think. But I guess my point is, how much additional auditing are we going to have to do with this bill the way it's set up?
Senator Wagner, through the chair, maybe I didn't quite understand your question. It won't take away any auditing necessity, because we'll still have to know precisely how much capital expenditure you had and how much your total tax base is. So it'll be identical to the amount of auditing that had to be done under any bill that has the capital credits. The only difference is, once we know that number, we then plug it in and run it through. But if you look, and Robin maybe can direct me to the page, if you look at the four items that need to be considered in the calculation, I believe that there'll be no additional auditing. I mean, one of them is your total capital expenditure. One of them is your total production tax value, and the other one is the tax rate. And we don't look at your actual tax rate. We go look at the federal code and say, what's the highest marginal rate? So this actually, I mean, I'd love to say it would, but it has no cost savings from the other bills that we've seen.
Okay. And just one other question before we get off the auditing. How many auditors, auditing positions, are you short at this time in the department? Or is the department short?
Through the chair, Senator Wagner, we've actually just hired several while I've been here in Juneau since the first of the year. So I believe we may have one production tax auditor position left vacant. Okay. That does not include the income tax auditors, but you asked about production tax auditors. I believe there's one position that's vacant at this time. And if I could just add to what Mr. Dickinson said about auditing, that's absolutely true. Under this bill, there's no change in the auditing duties, if you will, and in terms of costs on the fiscal note, you will see a slight decrease in the costs for the department on the fiscal note because we've gone from a monthly filing to a yearly filing. So in terms of the tax technicians that are needed, you will see a slight decrease in the fiscal note numbers, but that's not auditors, that's a tax technician position.
If members, we're having some difficulties with the sound system, making it difficult for some of the listeners on Gavel Gavel to be able to hear us. They're hearing Robin and Dan fine, but some of us, we need to make sure that we speak directly and loudly into the microphones, and they'll get the technical difficulty ironed out for tomorrow.
I'll try to repeat the questions when, if I hear them.
Correct. Next, someone. Okay, let's go ahead, Dan.
The final page on here, and we can walk it through again, this was prepared as a specific request, so it may or may not be less interesting for folks here, but it just walks through that same calculation, and I apologize, I don't have the officially titled version, looking at Exxon and saying ExxonMobil, because they're going to have a slightly different position, what happens if we take their current and walk it through? And I could take a couple of minutes to do that if you would like. Again, the rate, the daily price, and I apologize, Senator Stedman, that it is a daily price there, but the daily price minus 12 minus their spending, their estimated spending for the year, which is closer to $3, so you're at 58.47. As opposed to 56.83 in the prior example, and of course, because their production is only a fraction, we only have basically $3 billion of value that they are receiving as a consequence of their sales after deducting all their costs. Because their per barrel profitability is different because of their lower capital investment, their increment for progressivity is higher. So before, I think we saw it was 4.2. This is now 4.6. So it's almost a half a percentage point higher. If we look at the base rate, their adjustment for investment, instead of knocking 3.6 percentage points off it, only knocks about 2 off. So their savings are about $60 million. Then the anti-gold plating mechanism adds back roughly a percentage point, or $28 million. And then you add in the higher progressivity, or roughly $138 million, and the total tax burden prior to the credits is $855 million. But I think the real comparable thing is it's about a percentage point higher than the average on the slope. And so typically, the numbers we've seen, if we run this for ConocoPhillips, I think they were the largest investor or the largest estimated investments for 2006, I think you'd see that they'd be underneath the average by somewhat similar. You then have the investment credit of $35 million. Exxon would not qualify for the, I guess it's now the additional $12 million credit. I don't remember which exactly it is, but they would pick up some TIE. And so their net effect would be their net tax bill for this estimated period, if this bill were to pass, would be a roughly $800 million. If you go to the PPT as it was introduced, you would see the figure would be about $250 million less, primarily because you got 20% with none of the adjustments in there. And if you look at the status quo, now you'll notice that the percentage there is 12.75 because, again, Exxon primarily a Prudhoe Bay company. They have a very small percentage in Kuparuk. Essentially, all their production is in Prudhoe Bay, which is an alpha of about 0.85 times 15%. And so their average is closer is this 12.75%, generates $440 million on the higher tax base, which again is about $100 million less than the governor's bill would have had them paying. So that gives you an example of a taxpayer who has investments which are lower than average.
Lower than average. But it's interesting, if I look at this sheet versus the other one, if I look at the average, Exxon then doesn't quite double their tax bill.
That's correct.
Well, if I look at the sheet previously, on the average, this bill would bring the tax bill to about 272% on the status quo.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And one way to sort of step back 30,000 feet and think about this is currently at Prudhoe Bay, you've got a tax rate of, you know, as I say, let's just say roughly 13%, 12% of gross. ConocoPhillips has a field, you know, one field, the Alpine field, which has a similar tax rate. BP has one field, the North Star, that has a similar tax rate. But the second largest field in the United States, you're tired of hearing this, but I'll repeat it one more time. The second largest field in the United States is Kuparuk, owned about 50% by ConocoPhillips, a smaller share by BP. Exxon has under a 1% ownership. Their tax rate is going from zero to something approaching 20. So you will see that. So there is no question that under any bill which moves away from the ELF and replaces it with something else, it is those investors that have moved out beyond Prudhoe Bay and are typically paying the zero ELF in a number of fields who will see the largest increase.
And that's the point I wanted to bring up. Senator Stevens? Go ahead.
If you're going to ask it, go ahead.
I just want to bring that point out that it's not evenly spread across all the oil companies. It depends on where they're harvested.
Well, Mr. Dickinson, perhaps, Mr. Chairman, we can divert for a little bit from the bill to talk about the comment you just made, which I think is significant, and that is the talk of moving to just repealing the ELF or the talk of keeping the ELF in place as a temporary stopgap fix here during this time of uncertainty. If we keep the current system in place, Kuparuk will still not be subject to production tax.
Senator Stevens, through the chair, as long as you focused on the ELF and the ELF multiplies times whatever tax there is, that's correct. I suppose you could say, gosh, we're going to have a progressivity feature on all barrels, regardless of whether they pay an ELF tax or not. So, I mean, there are ways you could get around that, but you're absolutely right. Simply repealing the ELF would be a huge increase in the places with a low ELF and almost no increase in those fields which have a high ELF.
And Kuparuk has a high ELF.
Kuparuk has a zero ELF at the moment, and so they would see an infinite increase in their tax.
So, that's the point. I think one of the things about the petroleum production tax as designed was that it includes all production into the realm of production tax, but you know we've heard comments about saying, well, we've got this uncertainty. Maybe we should just repeal the ELF, put a stopgap in place. We're not including any of that Kuparuk into the formula. Then, if we just do that,
so Senator Stevens, through the chair, if the ELF were repealed, then there would be a huge payment on Kuparuk.
If it was repealed, but if it was just changed a little bit, then.
Senator Stevens, through the chair, I mean, that's correct. Obviously, there are ways you could change that would affect it if you just played with some of the parameters. You might not affect them. You might not affect Kuparuk.
Thank you.
Other questions at this point? Go ahead, Dan.
And, Mr. Chairman, that is actually the presentation that I had to discuss those. If we are called back, or maybe I can deliver to you the graphs. I do not have an additional set with those. I guess again, the point I would make is you will see that these tend to line up, except at very lowest prices, with the group of bills that have passed one house or the other. There are some differences. I don't want to trivialize those differences. They're billions of dollars, but fundamentally, it looks more like the bills that have already passed the House than either the governor's PT proposal or certainly the status quo.
Senator Stebbins?
If I could make one more request. When you redo the table at 70, would it be fairly easy for you to just do one at 50 and one at 30? This little summary table that we went over on second of your last page.
Let's do one at 50 and one at
30. It's a $20 spread, something easy.
Yeah.
And you can hold your CapEx somewhere constant. I'm just kind of curious about how this plays out, triggering into the gold plating and these other issues.
Can do that, Senator.
Thank you. 5 minute recess.
Now for 6 months, I start to become concerned about kind of the overall kind of concept in Alaska. It seems that either we prefer something that is very simple that doesn't work, or something complex that doesn't work, but something simple that works doesn't seem to get the votes, and consequently that is what actually concerns me. When I gave my first recommendation to the governor, I said it's very simple, do it like anywhere else in the world. We have lots of experience how these simple systems work. You just take a percentage of net profit, give some incentive like a tax credit, and you will get exactly, you have a simple system that's easy to administer, it has no problems, and the international experience proves that it works. And we now have a House bill that has many, many good features, I believe. It is a major progress on the text of the earlier bill. I do believe that the whole methodology of monthly payments with a simple system, just having interest payments at the end of the year if you over or underpay, I think that's a great simplification, and it is very sound. What I'm also particularly happy with is that a lot of the wording about cost control has been significantly tightened up, and I think so. Generally speaking, Mr. Chairman, I think much of the bill is very much improved relative to earlier concepts. I'm also pleased that the House has come up with a progressivity formula that I feel personally very comfortable with. As you know, previously I have urged the various committees to take the dollar figure where you started the progressivity somewhat high, 40 or 45, but after that you could have say a stronger progressivity. And so the $40 and the 0.25, I think definitely meets those standards as I had recommended earlier when I recommended against the $35. As I said, the item that I'm somewhat concerned about is the matter of the rate that has been discussed here. I'm a PhD in economics, and I have spent now 3 days trying to fully comprehend all the economic impacts, and I'm still not 100% ready, but I promise you, if you want to get some economic overview, and if you're interested in that, I can have it ready for you tomorrow morning early, if that is of the interest to the committee. So consequently, I'm concerned about the fact that that system is just too complex. I believe it is too complex, and I have concerns. I have some preliminary views on that, which I would be happy to share if you're interested, and I can provide a more fully economic documentation tomorrow if you are interested. So consequently, that are very important issues. Senator Wagner also asked my views as to what could be done to enhance the gross character of the bill. Are there things that can be done to make the bill more on gross and less on net? And I believe there are some things that can be done in the bill. I believe personally that a floor, as has been suggested a number of times, like in House Bill 3004, a floor whereby you say, okay, for instance, at $25 a barrel, we have at least 4% of gross or something of in that nature, and then maybe go down from there if the price declines, something similar to Bill HB 3004. I believe that could be an enrichment of the bill, not from an economic point of view. I personally don't believe that economically such an issue is not strictly necessary. I believe that the net system works, but I do believe that there is considerable concern out there among the people in Alaska, and concern like, if companies just keep deducting all these costs, we may end up less than we have now, and a floor concept would help. Another way of strengthening the gross character a little bit would be to restrict somewhat further the deductible cost. We have, as I mentioned before, in this legislature, in particular to your committee, Mr. Chairman, we have a laundry list of items that are not lease expenditures and that are therefore not deductible and therefore not subject to tax credits. That is very long, and I testified before that list is very much in line with even the most stringent international standards. But it is possible to add some items to the list if senators feel very strongly about these matters. So I believe it is possible to enhance the gross character of the bill somewhat through maybe a floor or through maybe some further additions to the non-deductible items. So basically, Mr. Chairman, that is my very initial view. I believe that the House bill is clearly an improvement. The text of the House bill, I think, is clearly an improvement over what has been there before. I'm very pleased with much of the language. I think it is really protecting Alaska very well. I think the progressive feature, although, of course, that is not in the governor's bill, but I have been testifying here about that. I believe that is very much in line of what I think a well-designed progressive feature would be. I'm concerned about the great complexity of the of this PPT rate structure, which I believe could cause quite serious gold plating. And I believe that it is possible to maybe enhance the gross character of this bill somewhat if there would be interest on the part of the senators to do so. And if there are any questions, I would be glad to answer them.
Senator Wagner.
You know, Pedro, my first question is on the formula. We have a formula that's this was item F on page 3, line 12. It starts.
Yes.
Goes through line 25, next page.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I want to go home and explain to my people what that says and go through it. If we took that out and put in a percentage as we've been dealing with in the past, that would be the place to stick in the percentage, say 22.8. That's what we came out with the conference committee, something like that.
Senator Wagner, as you know, the governor proposed it 2020, but from a structural point of view, if in section E, under section 5 in sub E, if it would simply say 22.8%, I would be so much happier than everything that is now under F. That for sure, because I believe whatever is now under F is horrendously complex, and I have very great concern about it. To give you a little bit background of the philosophy of that formula, I did extensive modeling work on that formula, and it of course, it is an easy formula. It is not more than multiplying, dividing, and subtracting. But the problem is all these factors kind of start interacting quite a bit. If you assume that the tax rate is a constant, and if you take a given value for the production tax, then really what this formula does is relating the rate, the PPT rate, to the qualified capital expenditures as a percentage of the production tax value. Now, it is easy to see. The easiest way to start with this formula is simply set QC at zero. Now, what do you get if you set Q0 at zero? Then R times zero is 0.2 times zero is zero. Then you get 0.25 minus air times PT times 1 minus IR, that stays, and then you get QC times IR, that is 0, and 0.75 to QC is also 0. From that, you can easily see that if a company would not invest one dime, but really not one dime, then this rate would be 25%. So that is the starting point. And then you can ask how much of the net profits does a company have to spend to bring this rate down? And basically, if a company would spend 23%, my calculation shows that if a company would spend, reinvest 23% of its net profits in Alaska, the rate would be 20%. So what we're saying with this formula in plain language is you, as long as you reinvest 23% of your net profits in Alaska, you can take 77% out, and you get a PPT, and you get rewarded with a PPT rate of 20%. In my mind, that is a harvester's formula. So consequently, I think the philosophy of this formula, as you say, there is a, as you can see, there is a direct relationship with the qualified capital expenditures and the rate. If you don't invest a dime, the rate is 25%. If you reinvest up to 23% of your net income, the PPT rate is 20, or the R rate is 20%. If you want to keep the rate at 22.5%, you have to reinvest 12.5% of your net profits. Now, to me, I feel very concerned about that. That doesn't sound to me as a, for, as a political expression that Alaska is very eager to encourage investors to reinvest. If you give them already a 22% rate, if they take 77% of their net out of Alaska, that doesn't really strike me very well. So that's my initial conclusion, and consequently, that's why, personally, I'm not so happy with this formula.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
There's been some discussion whether this bill is salvageable or not. It sounds like you think this bill is salvageable with certain changes.
No, as I believe this whole Section F is immensely complex. I did go through all of the steps 1 through 5 this weekend. I verified the math. All the math is exact. Dan has done his figure work correctly, and I can confirm to you that all these figures presented here are indeed correct. What concerns me is that what is sometimes called gold plating. This formula is presented as if it prevents gold plating. In my mind, it doesn't. In my mind, it slows down gold plating under very high prices, but it doesn't prevent gold plating. I just did a back of the envelope calculation. We've just heard that there could be very large new expenditures in the Prudhoe Bay field. My initial assessment is, based on this whole Section F, 10% of these expenditures or 20% of these expenditures would be paid by the oil industry. 80 to 90% of these expenditures would be paid through a reduction of the PPT. So that would be the consequence of this formula. I'm not sure how enthusiastic Alaskans would be today to step forward and say we are going to pay 80% of all these repair costs or even 90%. So personally, that is what I mean with gold plating. The state of Alaska would pay a very high share of any incremental investment, and that is caused by, firstly, the tax credits that we have, then the deductions, then the reduction of this rate, which lowers the which gives them a PPT reduction even more. And then don't forget, we still have the 2-for-1 system, which was an additional credit on top of that. So by the time you add it all up, in my calculations, in the $60 to $80 range, you get something like Alaska paying 80 to 90% of any repairs in the Arctic through reductions of PPT. And I personally would be very concerned about that.
Questions?
No.
Questions from Dr. Van Meer? Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, I'm glad you said it was complicated, because from the time I've spent with you the last 3 years, you've been a pretty simple guy, and when I saw this, I was quite surprised. And so I wanted to visit that, and I'm glad you said it, because
It's very complicated. I had mentioned earlier about the issue of inflation proofing. If this is a 25-year deal, were you here when I talked about the axis that Dan had showed us? And so don't we have to have some component of inflation proofing across the top in order to keep up with inflation proofing down the side? Is that something you looked at?
I think that is another deep concern I have, and I have done some preliminary modeling on that. The first thing to remember is that this formula is a dollar per barrel formula. Or in other words, if a company starts at 22.5% in nominal dollars, as long as they decline their investment at the same rate as the decline of the production, the rate will stay constant. But, or in other words, if your production declines 8%, then you can let your nominal investment decline by 8%, and you will still pay the 22.5% rate because it is dollars per barrel. So consequently, your rate stays constant as long as you decline your investment along with your decline rate of production. Now, this issue is further aggravated that if you would want to look at real investment, if you want to correct for inflation, what this formula is saying, you can significantly faster decline your investment than the decline of the field, because as long as you are in constant dollars equal to the decline of the field, you can still add the 3% decline on top of that. Or in other words, if you have 3% inflation and the oil field declines by 8%, your investments can decline by 11% and you still pay the same 22.5% rate. So that again is another deep concern that I have, but I think adjusting for inflation really wouldn't help. I think there are very fundamental problems with this concept.
You know, and I guess just simple math, and I haven't spent much time with this bill, so it just seems like what you just said, I had a note here, it seems like if it's investment over barrels, you could have a slight increase in investment and a slight decrease in barrels, and your tax rate either stays the same or goes down, which is exactly what, I mean, just the math seems like it works that way, which is exactly opposite what we're trying to do.
You are absolutely correct. My initial economic analysis shows that, say, if you start out at 22.5% and you decide to increase your investments by 10% per year in nominal terms for 3 or 4 years, and you let production decline by 8%, in 4 or 5 years you are down to 20% PPT, and then from then onwards you can continue to decline your investment at the same rate as the production decline. So with this formula, it is not difficult to get in 3 or 4 years to 20% PPT and then stay at 20% ever after.
Go ahead, Senator.
I guess I'm just, I'm a little perplexed. So, I mean, this is a basic tenet of this bill. When this was going through the other body, what was the response to this basic premise from the other body as we went through there? Did you tell them what you told us?
No. I did not testify to the House.
Well, last week you weren't in front of House Finance
testifying? No, I was testifying. I had received initial suggestions to think about that idea, and consequently, my reaction was that my instinct was that this would create considerable gold plating. And I said, if you want to make a variable formula, do it production-based. So I actually proposed the produce or pay concept that had none of these deficiencies. Now, as you know, Judy Brady, such a nice lady, was scared to death when I presented that formula, and I really don't like nice, elegant ladies to scare to death, so I still feel very bad about that. But what my formula precisely did was to actually guarantee that we would get the production, because that's the goal of Alaska. The goal of Alaska is to get production. So was I happy with my formula? No. I had proposed when at the end some of the legislators asked me, why didn't you present this before? I gave an immediate answer. I said, there is great virtue in simplicity. And around the world, there is such great virtue in simplicity that I would only recommend a complication if that is, and that is my exact words, I said, if that is what is needed to get this PPT passed. But otherwise, I would strongly prefer to have a system that is simple. We know international that a system that is simple works. It worked in Norway, it worked in Alberta, it works in the Canadian Arctic, it works everywhere, it works in Australia, it works everywhere where governments have already now 20 or 30 years experience. As I mentioned, the 2020, I could explain it in 5 minutes to the governor. You just take 20% of the net income and you give a 20% tax credit, and that's the whole system. That's all there is to it. Simple. And now we are here with something that is so complex that even I need 3 days to figure it out. So consequently, my strong suggestion is, why not go back and rethink this? Is it really so difficult to do something simple? Is it really so objectionable to do something simple? Why can't we just have a simple percentage? And why can't we just have a simple tax credit? Everybody in the world does it. Everybody in the world is successful with it. Everybody in the world has stimulated investment. And I think it was actually an interesting experience today, seeing suddenly Prudhoe Bay being shut down. It was a sobering look in the future. That's how Alaska may look like 15 years from now if we don't stimulate reinvestment. And that is so important. That is so important of a simple system that stimulates investment. Other nations know it does. It cannot be abused. It doesn't have all kind of these unknown side effects as these complex formulas have. And that is why I appeal to you to really consider, and I appeal to the House to really consider something simple. There is great virtue in simplicity.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Doctor. And you had offered earlier for some sort of an economic analysis. I guess when you said that, I said that you would just roll out what you have done for the House, but apparently.
No, I didn't do. No,
that's not rolling it out. That's actually doing it.
But I could. I could. If you're interested, I can have some economic analysis and some graphs ready tomorrow, illustrating each features that I just mentioned.
If it's okay with the chair, I'd certainly be interested in that.
Okay.
I'm here to serve. So is Dr. Van Meer.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for Dr. Van Meer? This point in time. Further comments, Dr. Van Meer?
I'm happy to answer any questions on some of the details that I also mentioned.
Okay.
Okay.
Pretty plainly laid out.
Okay.
Well, maybe I could review what I heard just to make sure I got my notes right. So, Doctor, you said you were concerned of its how complicated it is. You were concerned that it may be a formula for harvesters.
Yes.
You were concerned that it postpones but doesn't prevent or limit gold plating. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure what that means, but I think I know what it means. We don't take into account inflation over the next 25 years. And we're concerned about the ability to manipulate basic math to have, I just put basic math, the slight decline in investment, slight increase in investment, a slight decline in yes. production has exactly the opposite effect of what we're trying to do. Was that the five? Was there anything else?
I think that is a good summary, yes, of my initial concerns. I hope to document, at your request, I hope to document that better tomorrow.
Thank you.
And Dr. Van Meer, could I ask you to just be a little more explicit on what you believe, what is a harvester's formula?
The most nations that like to encourage investment think about encouraging reinvestment, that should be the majority of your net profits. If nations say we like to encourage reinvestment, they think that it should be, yes, nations realize that companies like to send dividends to headquarters, that they have to pay interest on headquarter loans. Countries know that some money has to go back to headquarters. Why otherwise would companies work? But what most nations try to achieve, and nations like Norway and Britain and jurisdictions like Alberta are achieving so well with these simple systems, is that 90% of the profits or 70% of the profits gets reinvested right back in the same jurisdiction. That would be a good goal, to say Alaska is happy if companies reinvest 23% of their profits. That really, I think most other jurisdictions would set their goals a lot higher than that.
Other comments, questions? Thank you, Dr. Van Meer. Let's just take about a 3-minute recess. Back on the record, we have a number of charts, graphs, information that we've requested from Mr. Dickerson, also from Dr. Van Meer. And so we will have those in the morning. We'll resume again tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. We'll take a look at those charts and graphs. If people have proposed amendments for discussion, we'll start there. And we'll work long into the night probably on this one if necessary. Get through this bill. Is there any questions or any comments from the committee members before we adjourn? Okay, thank you very much. It's now 23 minutes after the hour, 4 p.m., and we're adjourned for the day.